You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest is Michelle Ferrigno-Warren. Michelle is the Advocacy and Strategic Engagement Director for the Christian Community Development Association. She's an Immigration, Education, and Human Service Policy Specialist and an adjunct faculty at Denver Seminary. Michelle is a founding staff member of Open Door Ministries, and she and her family live in an immigrant neighborhood in Denver. Michelle, thanks for being on Seminary Dropout.
Well, thanks for having me here.
I think you mentioned in the book that you grew up in a middle-class, kind of suburban environment. Where was that?
Yeah, so most of my upbringing was on the East Coast in the tri-state area, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. And about halfway through high school, my dad, his job relocated him out in Colorado, which is where we moved, and finished high school there, went to college in the Midwest, and then the book kind of takes me from Texas on. But yeah, mostly in the Midwest, in the East Coast rather than the tri-state area.
Well, the book is called The Power of Proximity, Moving Beyond Awareness to Action. And you talk in the book about your journey and you and your husband's journey with just living in proximity to the poor and those in need. When did you first make that decision?
You know, my husband and I, when we were dating, I mean, even before we were dating, we both were pretty outreach-minded people. Anytime there was something to sign up for to volunteer, even whether it's, you know, tutoring in a juvenile detention center, which is what I did, or teach Sunday school, or go downtown and talk to homeless people in downtown Cincinnati. We went to school in Ohio. I mean, Dave and I were typically the first people to sign up to do that kind of thing because we understood, you know, just wanting to be the hands and feet of Christ, wanted to really be in relationship with people, and knew that our environment was more of a bubble, and so we wanted to get out. And so that was just the beginning of an awareness of what was going on outside of our world, and met so many beautiful people with definitely different stories, and the desire to do some type of full-time ministry. Of course, at this point, we're talking about together. Was at the forefront, and we all of a sudden began to realize that the cities in the late 80s and the early 90s, the cities were not the same as they were today. You know, gentrification was not even a word, and there was a desolation because so many people had moved out. A lot of the wealth had moved out, businesses stayed, but people were living in with the creation of the suburbs and, you know, farther and farther out, which is where David and I grew up. But we just began to get an awareness and a heart for the city and wanted to do ministry there. And then the conversations of where are we going to live? You know, usually when you think about a church, you are pastoring a church or being a part of a ministry, you live in that community. And the only reason we even thought not doing it in the city was because there was, you know, failing schools and, you know, it was the perception of danger and just a hard place to, you know, consider living and having a family. But at the same time, how can you minister to people from far away? So those were the conversations, and we just decided that, you know, if we were really going to love the community that God was drawing us to, then we needed to love it with everything and all of our time and not keep our feet in two different worlds.
You mentioned you first went to Dallas. What was that community like there?
Well, Dallas was definitely the first time we had ever lived in a community outside of, I would probably say, even an upper middle class or, you know, predominantly white community. And so David and I were actually the only white and married couple in our apartment buildings. And it was just a regular apartment, but all the buildings had Section 8 vouchers. And so everybody was on Section 8 except for us. And so it wasn't just being a dominant culture minority, but it was also our first introduction to living life alongside people who were poor, people who were, you know, trying to make ends meet. Some were part of the working poor. Other people were, on housing vouchers and more government programs. But but that was our living experience in Dallas, and it was really beautiful. I mean, I think stereotypes are really powerful, and you kind of think and you feel different than others. And, you know, in the city, everybody is so different that you go in, well, you should go in with a posture, and felt this posture of, we already know we're different, but how are we the same? And all of those sameness has really connected us beyond fears, beyond stereotypes, and made that living situation, which was an unlikely happy place, really some of our most beautiful memories, you know, of the early years of our marriage.
Well, one of the things that you touch on was just how when you move into a place that's a different culture other than your own, your concept of what seems normal gets challenged. What were some of those things for you when you first moved into Dallas?
Well, that was a long time ago, so I don't know if I even remember all of the many details. It was just this big cloud of difference. You know, anybody, I have a daughter who's lived in China and lived in Ecuador, and a son who's lived in Italy, you know, through foreign exchange. And you know, anytime you switch cultures, you know, you're a student of that culture, and you have to make space, you know, to listen and learn, and different foods and different sounds and different smells and different, you know, acceptable ways of doing things that aren't necessarily on a moral measurement, but just on how cultures feel comfortable. I think, you know, for me, as I don't know if I was ever taught that the cultures were different. I mean, we knew we were different, and we could feel the cultural differences, but most of the differences were separated by fear. And so a lot of the changes were really just how I saw the poor. You know, this idea that, oh, you wouldn't go live in the city, or you wouldn't put your, I remember once somebody telling me, you're going to send your kids to those local schools. And I was like, oh, yes, definitely. And of course, I was a teacher in those local schools. And they're like, well, our children are just too precious for that. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, I thought all of our children were precious, you know. And so this perception of, you know, that the other is somehow less desirable or a bad influence or less than, that's probably the biggest stereotype of all, is that I'm not better than people. And I think especially from a more white privileged background, it's just very easy to see, especially the poor. And, you know, a majority, even though there are a lot of poor white people, you know, in our cities, there's, you know, a lot of minorities who are poor, and that is really who my community has made up these last, you know, 24 years. There's this attitude that if you're poor, you must be doing something wrong, and I'm better than you, and you should learn from me. So I would say a lot of those stereotypes were really more the ethos and the social contract of the way we viewed people, the way we viewed vulnerable people, us as the helpers and them as the recipients, us as better and them as somehow less than. And that is obviously very, very wrong. And I think even from a theoretical viewpoint, as Christians, we know it's wrong. But when you move and you begin to live life alongside one another, it tests the wrongness of it. And so, sure, it makes it up in small things of where you park your car, you know, and how you take care of, you know, different aspects of your home, or just the way you dress, or what time you go to bed. Or, I mean, David and I have so many memories of how much lighter fluid you use on a balcony when people are standing above it on the other balcony. You know, those kinds of things that are just like, wow, that's really kind of shocking. You know, that aren't really a moral basis, but what happens is when you've been a part of a different culture and then you intrinsically think that you have more value, then every little difference can sometimes be rated on a moral scale where I must be still right and you're wrong, instead of you have a lot to teach me and you have a lot for me to learn. I need to learn a lot in order for me to not only make it in this culture, but for us to make it together, because I wasn't going home, you know, and I didn't want to. I really wanted to learn. And, you know, some of the beginning of that book is a very personal part of my journey of changing both inside and out, because I don't think we hear that enough. You know, a lot of the books that I've read often trumpet people from the outside as some collective savior. And I just really wanted to push back on that refrain and just reveal our own limitations and our own brokenness as Christians, and the need to tear down walls that we bring as well. And they're on both sides, of course, so that we really can be the community and experience restorative justice and shalom together. So yeah, it's a pretty personal story of my own arrogance and Narcissism.
Well, I think that most of us are kind of familiar with that narrative that you're talking about, where maybe we demonize the poor, or we think that they're poor because they're lazy or what have you. And then I think there's also this other side, that there's a certain group who would like deify the poor as well.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And I think that both of those seem to be different sides of the same coin, because both of them dehumanize people, because human beings are neither all bad or all good. And I wonder if that's, if kind of discovering the nuances between those poles is something that you went through.
Well, in order to have a sincere journey with anybody, you know, you're going to have to explore both sides of the coin. And so I would agree. You know, I think also different times, you know, when I started this journey so long ago, I remember saying, you know, God has a heart for the poor, and people would look at me like, are you nuts? You know, and the tide began to switch in the late 90s, where all of a sudden this narrative of God has a heart for the poor began to catch. Mm-hmm. And it caught in our churches in a really powerful way. And this idea of doing outreach, and you see a lot of growth in local outreach ministries around that time. And, you know, maybe this social response and generosity and mercy, you know, that's not such a bad idea maybe. And I think that's when we begin to see a little bit more like, oh, you know, the poor we need to even exalt and you know, put the poor on even more of a pedestal, because God has a heart for them. And I think that just misses the whole concept of justice and equality, you know, which really levels it all for us. And, you know, our need to move in wholeness together, you know, is really the more correct, just response, and recognizing that the poor often need a little bit more help because, you know, they are vulnerable, but it's not the same type of, I don't know, guilt or charity or pity, you know, that so often is portrayed. And I think that that's some of it too, honestly, is the more you're in relationship with people, you can't just live perpetually guilty or perpetually, you know, in any type of shame, or, you know, you need to really move to a true relationship. Otherwise you're going to be miserable, and everybody else around is going to be miserable as well. And I mean, the whole book isn't necessarily on proximity, but on its power. You know, I feel like there's a lot of reasons why you shouldn't choose the lifestyle that I've chosen. There's a lot of reasons that I've heard over the years, and, you know, everyone thinks, oh, that's a good idea, but I don't know how long I'll do it, or if I'll do it at all, or at least when I have kids, or maybe my kids go to school, you know. But I just thought there needs to be a case for why we should.
Do you think that that's something that everyone should do?
I do think that God has a heart for the poor, and I think that God's heart for justice and for everyone to move together in wholeness should be our heart. You know, I think you see that just even the whole concept of Jubilee, or, you know, all the Hebrew people, you know, they got their land, and, you know, things happen, that the readjustment of property and opportunities, you know, then there's this reset. And so I do think that the church does need to be very concerned about making sure that we undo the impacts of hardship or oppression or challenges. And so I definitely think so. And I think that when you are a person of privilege, you know, it's very hard to really fix a problem you do not understand or even be a part of the solution. And it's even more challenging when you're doing that from a distance. So I do think that if we are Christians, then we're going to care about the poor. You know, Christ says the poor you'll always have with you, and, you know, is referring to the Old Testament, that the poor were always around. And, you know, it's not more that we have just too many and don't worry about it. It's just like, that's just a part of our society, you know, and we always have that. We always need to be focusing on that. And at this time, you know, we were focusing on Christ's death in that particular story and, you know, reference. But I'm afraid that in 2017, we don't have to see the poor. You know, you can grow up for, you know, months and years and, you know, whole lifetimes and really choose not to because of socioeconomic opportunities. And I think that that's the bigger question, is does the church have a responsibility to the poor beyond ministry from a distance that requires just a little bit of money? And I am definitely on the side of, I think God's calling us to more, you know, and so do I think everybody should like dash to go move right now? No, I think there's a journey. I don't think you should hesitate, you know, to move and to allow fear to keep you from engaging. But I definitely think that we have a lot of growth in the, specifically in the American church, on how we look at the poor and how we walk alongside them and share each other's burdens and move towards wholeness. And I would definitely challenge a person who wants to do it from a distance.
Well, a lot of the book is on just the idea of letting go of the thought or the notion that we're going to go in and fix people. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be a progression that I see sometimes in people where they go from kind of not being aware of the poor and then being aware of it and then wanting to fix it. And then if they keep going, realizing that they can't fix it. and I wonder how you explain to people, in a culture, an American culture that is really about problem solving, why do it if you're not going to be able to make big changes on a macro level?
So I would say individual fixing is not a good idea, but collective working together towards fixing is the way to go. You know, you started by reading my bio, and you read all the areas of public policy that I work on. And the reality is public policy are solutions to problems. So it's disingenuous for me to say that I don't think we should bring solutions to the table of problems. I just think the way that we bring solutions of injustice and oppression that impact the poor, if the poor aren't at the center of those conversations, and if the poor are not able to articulate and champion their own, you know, limitations and be a part of helping to fix their own problems, then we aren't doing it with justice. And I think that those are some of the challenging questions. So yeah, I mean, I do agree. First of all, I don't see that many people lean in. I see a lot of disillusionment with, oh wow, I can't fix this problem, that I might as well just give up. And I do see that a lot. And I do want, in this, the message of the book is, you know, lean in. There's still so much to learn. I remember starting to think along these ways because I had been leading an intern program. I think it was in 2005. Somebody asked me, and at this point, you know, it's been probably, what is it, 12 years since I've been living in a community and, you know, doing the same thing that we're doing now in, you know, in less seasoned ways. And they said, have you made a difference? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, poverty is still here. Homelessness abounds. But, you know, there's no substitute for life on life. I mean, I was changed. People have made a difference in me. Of course, you know, our life invested in the kingdom makes a difference. I think what I'm pushing back on with the fixing is we don't want to fix problems. We want easy fixes. Mm.
And quick ones.
That's right. That's what easy is, quick. You know, it's a real big bummer that justice doesn't have this to-do list that we can just check off. You know, we're so linear in our thinking that if we're not, you know, working with that rise over run and we're not, you know, moving forward, that somehow something's wrong. Most like we look at our successes on a very linear timeline instead of a circle, that every time we circle, we get a little bit deeper. You know, our theology compels us to put our theology into practice, which is ministry. And as we're doing ministry, you know, we catch God's mission to rescue the world. And that screams, you're not the fixer, the Savior is. It doesn't mean that we're hopeless, that there's nothing to be fixed or there's no one to fix it. I mean, we carry around this beautiful hope and this treasure in clay and earthen vessels, you know, and we share it with each other and we realize that we are saved. We have, you know, we have hope and we have this ability to move together towards restoration because Christ has made everything right from where it's wrong. And as we learn that theology together, we put it into ministry practice and we continue to catch God's mission to rescue the world. And so you might look at it and say, wow, you only do three things. But I mean, you do it deeper and deeper and deeper, and it's not what capacity did we build and what did we erect in our honor and what did we check off. It's just how are we part of a collective narrative of God's redemptive process that started when brokenness began at the fall and continues to move about the world until he finally comes again. And, you know, in our day and age of quick and easy fixes, we want to measure our success. And when we can't, we feel like we must be doing something wrong. And I think that's really more what I'm trying to speak to, is get on board with what God is doing. Don't make it about you. Don't even make your moving in a social experiment. Get on board and join the Holy Spirit in the work that He's doing in your community, no matter what the community is, and be excited about what He's fixing for His good, and for our good, rather, and for His kingdom, and that stuff that lasts.
And I find, too, that a lot of people think that when Christians do something like this, that it looks like, or should look like, systematic church program where you move in and you've got like a 5-year, 10-step plan to transform the community and the people's lives in it. And I think one of the biggest takeaways is that it's not like that at all. And it's part of it is just being present every day in people's lives, just being there, like just being a neighbor, like you would anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I grew up in a community, I didn't get this idea that you shouldn't love your neighbor. I mean, I was loving my neighbor. They just all look like me. Yeah. You know, it just wasn't the same kind of distribution of resources, you know. And so this, you know, when you walk with your neighbor, if they're going through cancer or they're, you know, they're child was, you know, born with a disability, or, you know, you're loving them in deep and real ways. And the more you live life alongside them, you know, the more that you're sharing the journey. I just happen to share a journey with people who are part of a system that is quite broken with limited opportunities. And I, you know, one of the pieces of that power of proximity and that changed for me was my understanding of how far you were going to love your neighbor. You know, I full disclosure, you know, to you and to your listeners, I'm an immigration activist. I mean, I have no apologies. You know, I'll do whatever I need to do, you know, to make sure that I stand up on behalf of immigrants and immigration reform. But I didn't roll out of bed one day and decide to be an immigration activist. I happen to live in an immigrant community, and I decided to roll out of bed and be a neighbor. You know, and that neighbor's a pretty big word in the Christian faith. And you're supposed to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and then love your neighbor as yourself. And then we see the illustration, the parable that Jesus uses to back up what that looks like with the story of the Good Samaritan. And it really stretches you of how far will you love your neighbor. And the longer I've been here and the longer I was here, the more I realized that story of, oh, give a man a fish, he eats it for a day, teach him to fish, you know, he eats for a lifetime. I thought, well, not my backyard. My people who have fishing poles and they even have boats, they have no place, they have no permission to get in the water. You know, there's structural things that keep them from being able to move forward. And then I was being challenged with, do you believe that the systems are broken? And do you believe that your efforts or that your voice should be raised in order to make change? And that was a really big, hard question, because I think in the church, now you've been to a couple seminaries, you let me know, but you know, the written code that I've gotten is, yeah, we don't want to touch issues of, you know, federal housing or immigration or incarceration. I mean, that's political. Then we'll be considered liberals. And then, you know, we'll be ousted. You know, so those were kind of butting up against that aspect of a social construct as well. It was like, wow, I got to care about immigration reform too?
Speaking of just the systematic injustices, you tell a story about a mother in your neighborhood who pursued education really far, but because she had a drug conviction when she was 18 years old, she was a felon and couldn't get hired anywhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was absolutely not, it's a horrible story on her side for how hard she worked and how she butted up against everything, because she has a very nurturing heart. Let's just say that she's a very nurturing heart. She cares, she wants to care for people. So she decided to go to get her 2-year nursing degree. And so, you know, blood pressure is blood, you know, that kind of thing. And so she goes and does it. And then she finds out, I mean, the crazy thing is the government helped pay her school education, her education. Gosh. You know, nobody seemed to break the good bad news to her ahead of time. We all applauded the years she is a single mom, you know, worked towards that, and then she couldn't get hired because she had a felon and because she was working with people. Okay, so fine. So she goes to school and she studies to work for animals. I mean, because she loves people, loves animals, you know, nurturing. Same exact situation. You know, so you're absolutely right. I mean, it's not what happened to her at 18, a nonviolent drug possession. There are so many people in my community growing up that had drugs. They were using them. They were holding nothing different than her. She wasn't selling them. You know, she was using them. But we have over-policing in poor communities. Mm. We have, you know, frankly, unlawful searches and seizures. There are a lot of things you can get away with in a poor community in general because people don't know their rights or people don't feel like they can speak up for themselves or people are afraid of the police, you know, because different dynamics in different communities. And we see harsher sentences. We see, you know, more arrests, more convictions. And, you know, my friend was one of those people who at 18 was tagged for life and, you know, was not able to do what she wanted to do.
Let's go back to immigration a little bit. How did you get involved in that?
Well, it really definitely was by accident. You know, I don't usually try to poke angry bears, but I happen to be living in an immigrant community 20 years now. And in 2007, President Bush at the time was putting together some immigration reform legislation. I did not know anything about it. But I heard this guy, Tom Tancredo, talking horribly about immigrants. And I was just listening. I'm thinking, this is nuts. I mean, when did we start hating immigrants? And then he started to make sense. Oh, maybe I guess if there's so many people breaking the law and, you know, they're terrible criminals, then I guess maybe they should go back. Well, then I began to, you know, put two and two together, and I live in an immigrant community. I would recognize that, well, some kids would go back to Mexico in a family and others wouldn't, or some, you know, families like one parent would and one wouldn't, or they never went back, or parents never visited them. I mean, you live life alongside each other. You're like, you know, especially the Latino community, you know, there's a lot of family loyalty and you know, just in a very beautiful way, and just not seeing them practice what I would have thought looked like everybody free to move about, I began to put some pieces together and realized, oh, this must be what undocumented means. Yeah. Oh, wow. I didn't realize that this was my neighbors. And so I just learned more and more. I just thought it was, you know, I had been working on trying to learn Spanish. All my kids are bilingual and biliterate. I was learning how to make salsa. And, you know, there's all the things that you embrace in a culture. And you didn't realize that in order to love your neighbor as yourself, it wasn't just the immediate, you know, school and playground ups and downs and cheers and, you know, celebrations and then some of the common humanity sadness, but then there was these systems, you know, that caused people to have to leave in the middle of the night or, you know, be afraid that somebody was going to be taken away, etc. And then I began to meet people whose families were separated. And so you get to this point, you're like, wow, I need to learn more. So I just became, again, a student of what's going on and began to realize there was, I think, I didn't realize there was an injustice to it until I learned more. Learned more that we have this help wanted and do not cross duplicative sign at the border, and that 75% of undocumented immigrants pay taxes and they own small businesses, and you can pay taxes because the government's not going to give you a social security number to work legally, but they'll give you an ITIN number so that you can register it with the state and create your own business as an undocumented person and then use that same number to pay taxes to a system that you'll never see a penny, you know, and live in this subculture, you know, just hoping that nobody kicks you out. Until in hopes that generations behind you can have more security and education. And you just feel kind of dirty. Mm. You're like, what are we doing? And just looking at the narrative, and it's beyond the United States history, but when you look at the history of the United States and people of color and just some of my neighbors and friends, my heart was just grieved. It was just like, at what point will we stop the narrative that says we want your work? We just don't want you.
And I think one of the important takeaways from that is that living in proximity to immigrants allowed you to see the truth, because you could have just, if you hadn't lived in the proximity, you would have just heard the politicians and the talking heads who, you know, will spin statistics and cherry pick stories and cause you to live in fear and not see the truth.
I think there's some truth to that for sure. I think sometimes we have so much chaos that we get disillusioned and we think, maybe not today. And, you know, politics feels so personal and so emotional that it you do kind of want to, especially right now, I feel like the last couple of years, you just want to walk away from it. It almost seems like a godly thing, right? Oh, I can't take it. So social media anymore. I actually hate my family. You know, I can't do that. You know, those kinds of feelings. I mean, the irateness on social media seems like the holy thing would be to do is to give it all up. And I guess part of it is when public policy isn't politics. You know, politics is merely a game that we all play. We play it in our churches, on our church staff. We play it in our family. We play with our parents. You know, we play these games to figure out, when I put information out there, what information at what time would be the best situation to get what I want. Hmm. You know, and so we're very human beings are very good at playing politics. You know, but will we play politics, or will we be willing to go into the political sphere on behalf of the poor? It's a question that not many of us actually ever have to answer. But because of my proximity, it left me to sort of this place where the intersection of God's heart and my agenda for the poor was yet again intersecting. And I had to ask myself, how far are you willing to, you know, help your immigrant brothers and sisters? I mean, it's not enough to just collect backpacks for immigrant kids three blocks away. It's not enough to, you know, even get them good godly tutors who are going to teach them reading and math if they don't have status to be able to go to school.
I was talking with Russell Jung last week. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Of course, he endorsed my book. Good guy.
Okay, I didn't even notice that. Very similar story.
Mm-hmm. That's why I had him endorse my book.
With yours.
Actually, everybody I asked endorsed shares a lot of similar philosophies, which may not be a good book technique, but it helps me sleep at night.
Well, I mean, hey, it's
these
a who's
are people
who.
I respect. If they're endorsing it, go read their books, because they've been my teacher.
That's right. I wouldn't turn down an endorsement from, you know, Leroy Barber and Lisa Sharon Harper. And
that's
right.
They're good friends. They're good friends, and I respect them and want people to be directed towards their voices more and more.
Well, one of the things that I was asking Russell about was, or something he mentioned, was just how it really took it up a notch when he had kids. And
of course.
In his,
always does.
In his book, in his context, he emphasized a lot more of the violence that was present there, which is, I'm sure, something that you experienced.
Yeah.
And yeah, I wonder how that was for you, and how it changed when you brought your children into the picture.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of separates the men from the boys, kind of a thing. Yeah, I mean, child rearing in general is about the most terrifying thing that you can do, you know, giving life to something and the responsibility of trying to move that child in the right direction is just scary no matter where you decide to bring them up. But you know, my whole adult life has been one of just jumping in with faith. And it's not because I actually have the gift of faith or anything like that. I just would much rather follow the Holy Spirit. I feel so much safer following him. And I wasn't naive. I mean, I've witnessed some really, really hard things. And I hesitate even to share them, because I don't think we need any more reasons, especially from the white evangelical church, of why we would want to build walls and fences from the other. Mm. You know, so that's definitely something I didn't really focus on. I minimized it. One, because the pain is real, and the rawness of it is real, and the fear is real. And it's not that I hesitate to even share all of that. I just feel like the barriers between the rich and the poor and people of color and white people, they're so vast. We're such a divided people. We're such a divided church that if I focus so much on all the hard things that I've witnessed or seen, I might scare people off. You know, I'd rather, and it's not that it's not the truth or that I'm trying to lie or be misleading. It's just not a complete picture. You know, it's not a complete picture because there's always hard and there's always joy, you know, and so it's definitely a mixed bag. And so I would just say it's a different culture. I share a few pretty, you know, hard stories in those early years, regardless of kids, they were hard. And I just had to, it was almost like you need a new readjustment to culture. How we normalize gunshots or being propositioned, you know, by people as you walk down the street, you know, like, yeah, you just normalize those kinds of things. That's, you know, sort of the process of it all. And it isn't that it's easy. It's just becomes a little bit more familiar. You know, familiarity has a way of breeding comfort. And it's still very much home. But yeah, we definitely had some hard things and, you know, continue to have hard things. But, you know, I grew up, I mean, when I moved to Colorado a few years, about a decade, not even a decade after, you know, our family moved to Colorado, I our house, my childhood home in Colorado, was a mile and a half from Columbine. So, you know, I don't want to pretend that it's everywhere because it's not everywhere, but you can't control what's going to happen. And so that was really more of my attitude. And I just felt like our children, you know, Satan could use that as a bone of contention in our marriage or in our decisions for life, or we could just join the Lord. You know, I had this, I will share a story. It's an interesting story. I'm not exactly sure why I'm going to share it, but maybe it'll be helpful to somebody who's listening or you. Or maybe I just need to get it off my chest. But when our kids were little, my husband and I grew up in a lot of educational programming. I mean, we pretty much knew the Bible. You just could not know it. Whether you loved it or liked it or not, you just knew it. Because you're at church so much and they were just, you know, really teaching us. And that was good. It was a foundational piece of my childhood and teen years and formative, as well as my husband Dave's. And if you're at a homeless church for 21 years, let me tell you, you don't get that. You don't get, there's nothing, you know, that's just nothing unless you decide to create it. And so, oh, people were, you know, I just really knew that, I mean, David and I both sensed that our kids were supposed to not be maybe contracted out to other churches to, you know, get their Bible training or whatever. And so it was, I think it said was probably our oldest was like 5 or 6. And I kept thinking about Awana. Now, I had never done Awana or Bible memory like my husband had, but he had done Awana. And, you know, there was just so much knowledge, you know, and it was good. And, you know, obviously he's a mature Christian who has it in both his head and his heart. But, you know, I just remember feeling like, oh, maybe we should do this. And I was wrestling with Lord because I knew he was saying, no, not for you. And I was like, how is that possible? These are good things, God. I mean, how could you not want me to do that? And so in that wrestle, and, you know, I wasn't making decisions. I was just wrestling. It was a period of time, probably over a couple months. We had had this thing at church, and a woman had shared something, and Sydney was walking down the wheelchair ramp, you know, for at our church, and she was just sort of humming to herself and sort of skipping. And she just looks at me with the most beautiful, spirit-filled, genuine response and said to me, Mom, I just felt so inspired to love God because what so-and-so shared. And I'm almost ready to cry when I think about it now. And I was like, shame on you, Michelle. Shame on you to think that your child would be better off learning in some other formal place to drive your agenda for her forward. And right here, she has everything she needs because I'm the all-sufficient one and I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And it's not your game.
I mean, one of the things that I think when you tell that story is that that other way is, there's not anything wrong with it in and of itself.
No.
But it's also,
no, there isn't.
it's also like a pretty middle-class white American way to do things too, you know, that we often think is the better, best way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Also, I think one of the things you're getting at, in addition to the violent aspects that we would worry about when bringing kids into this kind of situations, but just the what we perceive as a lack of opportunity in maybe in church, but also in their schooling, which is like just I am convinced is like the number one idol of American Christians is getting their kids into good schools.
Sure, sure.
But that's
sure.
That's a real thing, and it's a real sacrifice. And also, I think a lot of people would struggle with being able to, like, it's one thing to say yes to your calling and then to bring your kids into it without them having a choice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that was like the biggest guilt of all. I mean, David and I had these wonderful upbringings, these beautiful cul-de-sac neighborhoods with creeks flowing in the backyard and, you know, happy swimming pools and green belts and, you know, the most wonderful opportunities and popsicles with friends. I mean, our children's lives have not been at all what this, you know, idyllic American suburban, white suburban even, or just suburban life, or what we thought was the right way. And I think that's part of the undoing, is there's more than one way to do stuff, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, this wasn't a one-time sacrifice. This was a daily, you know, reminding of call. And I do think call is important, you know, for this. And I think there's no way, I didn't do this on my own strength. I didn't, you know, just sail through it. I mean, I continued to just push into the unfamiliar, and God was delighting us. And, you know, my kids are different. I mean, they are very different than they otherwise would have been. I mean, that's pretty apparent, just the way the way they act, the way they choose. They all speak three languages. I mean, there's just things that they do and know that God has made up for in other ways. But yeah, that was probably the hardest thing, was like, what kind of jerk are we? But I mean, it's interesting that I wrote this book. I mean, we've got a senior in college and a sophomore in college and a sophomore in high school, and we're on the other end. And, you know, I know people who have been like us within CCDA. I think of Andy Bales and Kit Danley and Noel and Marianne Castellanos. And, you know, there's so many people who have, you know, who went before us and did what we've done. And they've got amazing families and amazing, vibrant kids who don't seem like they suffered. But if you sat down and wanted to do a podcast with all our children, I'm sure that they would have stories, you know, that were a little bit unusual. But, you know, the reason I share where my kids are now, I mean, Sydney's got a paid fellowship at Princeton this summer, and, you know, my son has got an institute, he's at the McCain Institute. I mean, like, they've had wonderful educational opportunities, and they didn't go to the best schools. You know, I mean, I think the average ACT score of my son's school right now is a 14. It's average, you know, so, I mean, there's definitely some things, but that's what we're trying to do, is we're not trying to preserve Michelle and Dave Warren's kids from the impacts of the poor so that they can be like these silver bullets. Mm. It's how do we live together so that Sydney and Alec and the Warren's kids' friends and, you know, all the kids in the youth group and at that church, you know, we all move forward together. They all have opportunities. And when you own your community in that deep way, you're not just thinking about protecting your own children and their future. You're thinking, what are we going to do to change this so that all of us can move forward? And I do share that, a story, you know, about our kids' school and how I didn't, that's how I, the very first time I'd ever marched in a march, you know, against something. It's kind of funny now because I've done so much bunch. It's hard to believe that would be my beginning, but I did it because I was fighting for my family. I was fighting for my school. And when I say my family, my community family, you know, that's the power of proximity. You don't even realize you're getting swept up in the tide because it becomes the very fabric of who you are. I mean, at this point, I've lived more years in a poor community than I lived in my, you know, original culture and community that I came from. I mean, I'll always be able to speak my native tongue, but, you know, but it's a beautiful life. I mean, it's definitely unique and not cookie cutter, but I couldn't have predicted the way it would end up, and it's not over, but, you know, God, I think that's the reason I shared that one verse in Jonah. And I just want to say this, that the NIV changed in the last 20 years. The verse that I used in Jonah, I don't remember the reference, but Jonah was fleeing God, and, you know, he finds himself in the belly of a whale in a different place of submission. And he says, those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that could be theirs. Now it says something different. I remember when I read the book after it was finished and done, I was like, hey, that's not what the NIV says. And I found out there's a different translation. But this idea that we hold on to things, and you said you think education is one of the American idols. I mean, education is important, but we shouldn't hold on to it just for us. We should hold on to the desire for everybody and work to make sure that everybody has that access. It's not like, oh, do I have what I need? Oh, good. Oh, phew. I don't care about anybody else. I think there's a lot of, and Jim Wallace just wrote a book in this last couple of years that's called America's Original Sin and refers to racism. And I you know, talked to him a little bit about it and said, I think it's a great book and I do agree. But I was like, you know, I don't know if it's the only original sin, or I said, when I think of America's original sin, I think of rugged individualism. Mm. This idea that I only have to look out for myself, and that if I take care of myself and I'm doing okay, then all is well with the world and God sees me and smiles. I just don't see that narrative at all from Genesis to Revelations. I think it's a complete lie that I only have to care for myself. So yes, my children have had to, I've had to make sacrifices. My children have had to make sacrifices, but all we did was enter into the story of other people, and together we've all wanted the same thing, which is success.
I think that also really exposed the conditions of our hearts and our priorities, because if your number one priority is for your children to be wealthy someday, then it's super important for them to be in a good school, you know, from pre-K all the way up. But if it's a higher priority to live in solidarity with the poor, then that would be okay.
I think you can live in solidarity with the poor and be very successful and wealthy too. I mean, I think, like I said, it's the goal of what is the Christian call to biblical justice and community. I mean, justice seems to be such a, I use this phrase in the book, that it's become so overused, it's been codified and it's losing its value. And, you know, I mean, I've been doing this for a very long time, and I finally decided to start preaching what I've been practicing, you know, because there's a lot of words that we use in evangelicalism that we create, sort of neologisms that pop up. And, you know, everyone's like on the new big word. And I remember people asking me about one word or another over the last couple decades plus, and I would say, oh, that's sort of a temporary thing, you know. The word missional is what's coming to mind. I just thought, oh yeah, well, we'll wait and see if everybody. I mean, I was living a missional life, and that's what people were asking me. Do you think they're going to all start missionally living, like, you know, you and other people? I'm like, probably not. I think it's just the new buzzword, you know. And I remember telling somebody, I was like, and they're like, are you going to push back on that? I'm like, absolutely not. It's not really a biblical word. I said, now if they start talking about the word justice and they start watering it down, then you're going to hear me say something. Well, here we are.
Here we are.
2017, right? All we do is talk about justice, and we want to make it a thin and airy and light thing. We want to pretend compassionate acts are justice. We want to pretend that every Christian that, you know, has it tattooed on themselves and like cares about justice is deep. It is radical. It is transformative. It is not simple. And it does not come without personal decision and sacrifice and surrender. The gospel is justice. Everything that was broken was restored because of who Christ was. That's what justice does. It restores people to their productive place. That's the message of the gospel. And if you're going to be a gospel-driven person, then you're going to seek the restoration, the shalom, the wholeness of everyone. And you can't use the word justice for yourself and for your family or even for your own individual, you know, siloed church. It is for everyone, and that should be where our heart is. I think we need to keep leaning into what biblical justice looks like. It's interesting because I feel like justice is such a trigger word in the church, and it sort of cracks me up. I'm like, I was just speaking to a group of college students not too long ago, and they were like, well, if we use the word justice, and then they started to kind of share those stereotypes. And I was just like, well, you need to remind your pastors that justice is not like some liberal word. It's a biblical word. It's a word we should be embracing, and we should be looking at it very, very deeply and allow it to challenge our hearts, to challenge our minds, and to challenge the way we live it out.
I wanted to ask you about just the trickiness in writing a book like this that could inadvertently make yourself look like the hero, or even say, hey, let's give up all of this middle class stuff and go live this sad life that poor people have no choice but to live. And talk about the things like we're talking about, like with schools, when obviously all of these other kids, they have no choice but to go to these schools. That's their reality. It's not, this life isn't tourism for those people.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think I've had to wait a long time to write the book because I wanted to wait till I wasn't angry. Because I think there's some process of a lot of emotion. I think if you read this book and you walk away that I am a savior, you have not read the book. I think, I mean, it's a hard book in some ways because it calls out elements of white Christianity in a very prophetic way. Another person, I was on another radio station, not that radio program, and after the program was over, the woman who had read the book said, "This is hard to read." And I said, "Yeah, I know. It's like swallowing something crunchy." I said, "It hurts when it goes down, but it'll go down." This book isn't about me. I use a lot of my own personal story because that engages a reader and because I'm tired of a white savior. I'm tired of white saviors who don't want to talk about race and who don't want to talk about privilege and somehow think they have to hold on to it. And those are two very, very powerful chapters that, often we don't get to in a podcast. But when you are, as a white person, trying, if you're trying to build yourself up as some big leading white voice, then you don't very strongly and critically and prophetically cry Black Lives Matter and Brown Lives Matter. And that privilege needs to not stand in the middle, and privilege doesn't, massage the egos of both sides, but it picks a side. It sides with the poor. Those are, if anything, I hope it's an inspirational book to drop everything and run and follow Christ. Don't follow me. I'm not going to be there for you. It's not going to work that way. This is a book in a reaction to the justice movement in the white evangelical church that wants to make a thin justice to say, not so fast. It needs to be deeper. And if it's going to be deeper, then you don't go in as the white savior. You don't go in with all the answers. You go in a posture of listening. And if you can't embrace your white racial identity, and if you can't give your privilege and power away, you aren't going to be able to do what you think you're supposed to be able to do. And it's this is, I think that's a danger that we always have, no matter who the protagonist of a story is. And it's always going to be a concern, but the reality is that I don't want anybody, I mean, there's nothing in that book. I certainly don't want anybody to feel sorry for me. I've had a great life, and that's one of the reasons I have chosen not to put some of those things in there, because I don't want it to sidestep the great work that God is doing in his church and doing in community with the poor. I mean, I'm not the gift of the poor. They've been a gift to me. And the power of proximity to the poor isn't because it made me a champion. It showed me my brokenness and my weakness in such real and present ways. Instead of running from it, I let the poor, sort of rehab us all back together. I don't feel sorry for the kids in my community because they have a bad school. Because that's what awareness does and limited action does. I want to call the church to say, don't feel sorry for the poor. Stand with us and let's fix the schools. I would never want us to just bear witness to horrible oppression and, think that our backpack drive is going to fix something. I think all those things are good. Trust me, I want people to donate backpacks and I want to give them away. But, I think that if anything, it's just a call to not just radical living so that you look like a good person or that people feel sorry for you. I mean, that is a missed, that's a missed message that it's really trying to be, which is poor don't have to stay poor. If we join God in his heart for justice and we're willing to put our agenda and our desire for self-promotion and stuff and security and protection, if we didn't have any of that, we'd have an awful lot of time to really join the poor and let's change the systems together. I talk a bit about that, especially in the last section of the book. Of when I as a social justice activist, like I said, I don't fight for issues. I fight with my family, my community, and when you're doing that, you can get very burnt out. And so, really, just want people to understand that they're going to have to deal with race and privilege, and then if they want to do this long work, they're going to have to work across, not just race and socioeconomic class, but interfaith work and what does that and people who have different political, affiliations. I just don't feel like we're calling for any of that. I think people desire, but they don't really even know how to make those steps. And so, you know, that was really a lot of the reason that I wrote it. And, you know, if it ends up getting a bad communication, I'll just have to give it over to the Lord, like I've had to give everything else over. But that certainly was never my intent at all.
Well, and that didn't come across. And that's why I said
you.
the challenge of writing it not that way, because that's always really, it's tricky.
You know, another thing though is you're right. And this was another thing, is I chose a downwardly mobile life. I mean, I didn't have to do this, and that's kind of the proximity and the choice in it. And I'm thrilled that God called me into it. Maybe I would end up in a belly of a whale if I didn't, I don't know. But I think I did intentionally not use people's names. And I did not like give huge amounts to their stories, not because I don't value those stories, but I really did not want to gain on their stories. It is a sacred place to have the secrets and even to bear witness to some of the most painful things people go to. And this idea that I would write that down and chronicle it and all the greatness that working together we've changed, I mean, like, that just felt scandalous. And so I thought, how can I give integrity to these amazing, wonderful people who are resilient and strong and passionate and teaching me so many things, and give enough of a glimpse of them as my teachers without dishonoring them and benefiting from their painful story? That was something I was worried about, and made very specific decisions as I wrote to make sure that didn't happen.
Michelle, thanks for being on the show and talking with me today.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It was definitely intriguing and interesting, and I appreciate the space to talk about it, and look forward to hopefully connecting with others who are listening, and the message of the book would go out in its truest sense, and that we'll be able to share a journey together.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,